start the tape now.
My name is Mark Mullinax. I'm from New York City. And this is the last of a series of talks about Christology, which is the study of Jesus Christ. The first time we talked about the necessity of being flesh, the absolute requirement that Jesus be incarnate, and how, even though it may be messy and sensuous and sensual, this should not implicate our view of Christ. Our view of Jesus. And we try to make a differentiation between Jesus and Christ. Christ is not the last name of Jesus, but is a title, like Sir David or Mr. Somebody. And then we talked about how in the second session about how the Christians made Jesus Christ, to the Jews' consternation, because Christ means Messiah, and the Jewish people were not ready to make this messianic claim. And so the Jewish people, even to this day, will claim that we have historicized what for them is an event of history that should be at the last of history. But we have placed it sort of in the midpoint of history, made it the center of history, and defined all other history around that midpoint. So there's this, to their point of view, a very illegitimate, illegal move there. Today, I'd like to talk about Asia, and how Asian people, or a few of them, have taken this vision of Jesus Christ and worked it with the leaven and the clay of their culture and come up with some very interesting views of Christ. Now we have two people from Asia here at least. Were you born in Asia?
No, I was
born in Honolulu. How many people have been to East Asia or South Asia or any part of Asia? Starts in Turkey and ends in Japan. You just got back. Okay. How long ago and how long was it?
Briefly in Turkey 40 years ago.
Okay. All right.
Yes. I was in Turkey 2 years ago for 3 weeks with Elder Hospital.
Yeah.
I was two different times, 2 months, 3 months in parts of Southeast Asia as well as India. Taiwan.
Right. Anyone else? You just got back.
I've been over there 4 or 5 times. India, Hong Kong, yeah. Mainland China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan.
Yeah. I don't like to use the word Orient, because the opposite is Occident, and we just don't use that word, even though you know what it means. I like to use the word West Asia, Central Asia, South Asia, East Asia. Try to be it, because you speak of Orient. You know, you have an oriental carpet, it could be from Turkey. It could be from China. And there's thousands of miles, many time zones. First of all, I'd like to give an overview about Asia from a theological point of view, and setting the context for how Jesus Christ may be said to be Christological in their cultures. Asia is a mosaic. It covers, 7 or 8, 10 time zones. The continent stems from Turkey to Japan. It features hundreds of languages. There are 7 linguistic zones. There are all kinds of groups, from the ideological Shiite groups in Iran to the Maoris in New Zealand. There are the neo-samurai, ultra-modernistic views of Japan. We have just amazing number of groups here. The most populated countries here. 1 out of every 5 people in the world speaks a Chinese language. 58% of the world's population is Asian. 58%. Almost 6 out of 10. And that in itself is just a very compelling statistic. But we can be overwhelmed with these numbers, and I don't want us to be. What it does mean for the people of Asia is one word, and that is suffering. because Asia, by and large, is very poor. I want to point out that there's a quality of suffering in Asia that is unlike anywhere else. You may think that you've seen suffering in your hometown or in the United States. You ain't seen nothing yet until you've been to places like Calcutta or places that have been repressed by political regimes. There's just a different quantity and quality to the suffering of Asians. And I want you to keep a mental finger on that word as we think about Christ. More Asians are hungry, more Asians are homeless, more Asians are unemployed, illiterate, than anywhere else in the world, in fact, than all the world put together. And that includes Africa. More people are despised, humiliated, cheated, more suffer from military oppression, from economic oppression, than all the world combined. The situation ain't improving either. It is getting worse. 80% of Asia's workers live in pretty bad poverty. They're exploited by local and international capitalism, to put it mildly. Most do not own land. Most are underemployed, if they're employed at all. 2 out of 3 Asians live in rural areas, and they suffer the usual endemic litany of low wages, feudal systems, landlordisms, and the extortions that happens. And then I'm not even mentioning right now feminine issues, because each one of these issues is magnified if you're a woman. Philippines is still trying to put its land reform back together. Bangkok has some very demeaning textile companies that exploit the workers there. Now, the suffering in Asia is unique because this suffering has spawned some great religions. What is the first precept of Buddhism? Life is suffering. The first of the 4 noble truths of Buddhism is life is suffering. Whereas Christianity and other religions have arisen in response to questions is, who are the gods that protect our empire? Or how can we gain control of this river? Or gain control of these storms? These are not Asian questions. Their question is not even how do we get out of Egypt, even though Christianity started in Asia. But the Asian religions I'm speaking about is how do we escape this worldly bondage, this ever-present suffering. I think the suffering, as you will, and you may want to debate this, is a result of human sin. There are rich and powerful people, often people from our nation, representing our race, who crush poor people effectively, efficiently, with great managerial skill. It preys primarily on women, the slow, the ignorant, the people who can't keep up with our fax machine technology, the speed of our technology here. Have been played out in Asia as nowhere else in the world. These range from the outright repressions of the Indian nationals in India to the, we call them the kleptocratic policies, the stealing policies against the native peoples of Australia and New Zealand. How many people can even, did you know that there's some native peoples in Australia and New Zealand? We just don't hear from them. Japan too has some, but how often do we hear the Ainu people in northern Japan? In the 1900s, imperialism of Western countries was particularly located in the ports of China. And they were ready to commit any subterfuge, these Western powers, to gain any control. Had this especially pernicious policy called extraterritoriality, which is a legal term. It meant that foreigners in China were subject to the foreigners' laws, not subject to the Chinese laws. And so foreigners could do anything with impunity. And it was up to the foreign nations to punish. And, you know, when you're halfway around the world and it takes 3 months to get there, I mean, who's going to be very responsible in such a situation? In the 1890s, U.S. business took this line. If we can convince the Chinese to lengthen the hems of their garments by just 2 our factories in the United States could benefit in an unprecedented way. There's been this American fascination with the China market. It happened in the 70s and 80s with the wars between Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola. You may remember those. The China market. If we could just convince these a billion people to do it our way, there's going to be money coming out of our pockets. And this has also happened in missionary circles as well. The so-called open door policy of the United States toward China at the turn of the century began with thinking that U.S. products should have equal footing with Japanese products, German products, Russian products. And we still think this way. Look at Japan, our trade imbalance with Japan. But this open door policy with China began to become more culture. We thought that we should be able to influence China, the Chinese values. We think that the United States values religion, culture should be in China before Japanese culture, before Russian culture, before German culture, and the other colonial powers. So it was a race to rape China. China's always been a fascinating place. My former missionary society, the Southern Baptist, still salivates at the chance to go back to China. They would just love to be able to say, oh, we now have our missionaries back in China. I mean, that was just the dream 100 years ago for missionaries. Go to China, convert the heathen. Well, sadly, the Christian religion has been near the front edge of Western push into these places, especially China, but also India, Indonesia, and Philippines. These people have been repressive, and Americans have always needed their court theologians, and these are the missionaries, pretty much. The first Christians, however, to reach India were the Portuguese, whose official policy was to make Indians more Portuguese than Christian. Yeah, this would make them better Christians. And it goes down or up from there, depending on your perspective. Churches have ended up as second-hand institutions, imported wholesale. I dare you to go into a major mainline church in any Asian city, if you can find it. And you'll hear hymns that are familiar. You'll see architecture that's familiar. If you can understand the language, the Christology will probably be about the same. Triumphant, Easter-centered, not necessarily Good Friday-centered, but Easter-centered. It would be pretty much familiar. You would not see much that's different. Now, there are notable exceptions, and we're going to get into those. But I'm saying, on the whole, the colonial religious push has matched the colonial economic push, the colonial political push, and these have been hand in hand. We call it God, gold, and glory. Get them there. And just convert the people. Prior to World War II, most Asian countries were the colonies of either Western powers or other Asian countries. Within a generation, however, most of these colonies have been liberated. And in many of these colonies, there has been unbelievable transition from a very unmodern society to a very modern society. And so you have modern, often Western views imposed upon these countries. And so you have tremendous dissimilarities between Eastern ways, Western ways. But the pernicious thing about that is that the oldest generation does not understand the youngest generation in these countries. And these countries, which are often Confucian values, intergenerational experiences, are just dumbfounded. And it's hard to talk between one generation and another.
need to sponsor overt business ventures or overt political ventures or overt military ventures into these countries. The day of the military gunboat diplomacy is over in Asia, but the day for the economic gunboat policy is still there. And so Western, I'm talking about European and American primarily, international corporations will be in these places like Bhopal, India. Remember Bhopal? And they will be paying these people poor wages, asking them to do dangerous jobs, and pretty well messing up the countryside in the process. Bhopal is just a famous example, and there are many not so famous examples. The religious neocolonialism is still at work. There is a residue of missionary activity, and I have participated in this missionary activity myself 12 years ago in the country of South Korea, and I lived there for 2 years. We have, and I'm speaking personally, I encourage people, Koreans, to forget their cultural heritage, to forget the traditional ties that they may have that are religious in nature, that bind them to their culture, that bind them to their land, that bind them to their family. And I've tried to present Jesus as, you know, I can remember strategy meetings of missionaries trying to say, well, we can say Jesus Christ is the older brother in a Confucian relationship, and try to graft on this Jesus and say Jesus is the answer, the pernicious thing. I'm using that word a lot. But the bad thing about this is that we missionaries went over there, and what did? We taught them the questions to ask. These questions, the questions that we think that Christianity ought to answer, are questions that have been given us. We have been indoctrinated, even in the United States, to ask the right questions. And then, presto, Jesus Christ is the answer. The same thing happened in Korea, and I'm sure it happened in other places. We encourage people to ask the questions we would formulate them. Why am I like this? Why am I being paid so poorly? Or why did my aunt die? And we encourage them to think in terms of sin, in terms of personal ways, and then say, presto, Jesus is your answer. So we manipulate the questions and then present Jesus as the answer to those questions. Now, my thesis is this, that Jesus Christ cannot and may not be bound to one context, Eastern, Western, Northern, or Southern. Responses to Jesus will continue to come and will continue to arise from a great many contexts. The study of how Asians perceive Jesus Christ is a fascinating sociological study as well as a theological study. I'd like to present some homegrown images of Jesus, not some imported views of Jesus, but homegrown from India and China and Korea. And I'd like for you to see, if you can, or challenge me if you don't, how these images protest against the Western images of a triumphant Christ that is the answer to questions that were already manipulated in the first place. One of the issues is, and you may want to ask this at the end, should not Jesus be the same everywhere? I remember in church school, in Sunday school, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, tomorrow, everywhere. Should not Jesus be the same everywhere? Should he look the same, have the same mission? The Jesus I was brought up to adore was a more spiritual one, not so much interested in the social issues. Should not we be also expecting to see a spiritual Jesus in other places too? So that's a question that we may want to ask. The colonial Christ is presented as a Christ against the culture of these East Asian and Southern Asian places. the colonial Christ is interested in controlling the Christological conversation. The colonial powers are interested in having a Jesus that says, don't mess with the system. Tune your heart, get your heart in order, get your life in order, maybe help your family get their lives in order. But don't mess with the system, don't mess with the economics, certainly don't mess with politics. Jesus has nothing to do with the reunification of Korea. Jesus has nothing to do with these colonial things. So let's keep Jesus interested only in soul winning. I don't want to use the word badly, but the evangelical message. The Christianity presented in Asia is often a capitalist, a mercantile one whose message is more personal rather than social. So I'd like to highlight some very imaginative Christ that Asians have developed on their own out of listening, that are often out of listening distance to Western theologies. They have emerged only when sought in critical conversation with one enemy of both true religion and poverty, and that one enemy is mammon. Remember I asked you to take to keep a finger on the image of suffering. In Asia, the one enemy of true religion and poverty is mammon, or money. So let's see how these Christologies work. A rich religion and a rich Christ, I must say, do not work in Asia. The disturbing thing about liberation theology, to me, as a person who makes much less than I thought I would even by the time I'm now my age, the disturbing thing that liberation theology say is that I will not hear the gospel, that I cannot hear the gospel. I am incapable of hearing good news because I am not among the people that Jesus came to. I am not living my life in solidarity. That means in community with, earning the same kind of money, living the same kind of conditions as the people who make up most of the world. Remember, Asia makes up 58%. Most of these places, most of these people are very poor. The disturbing thing is, you may want to contest this and we can talk about this as an issue. Can I hear Christ calling? Well, I must admit that only the poor want to hear a message. And I'd like to present some images. First, in India, is the unknown Christ of Hinduism. Followers of Hinduism, who are also Christian, have found two Christian scriptures that are very liberating to them. Somebody have access to a Bible close by? In the book of Acts, there are two passages. Acts 14, 16 through 17.
What was it, please?
Acts 14, 16 through 17. In the past generations, Jesus allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways. Yet he did not leave himself without witness, for he did good and gave you from heaven rains and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with good and gladness. I should have said God. In the past generations, God allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways, yet God did not leave God's self without witness. So, Hinduism is a Christological religion, according to some people. According to some Hindus. How do they do this? They say that Christ has been, ever since the first, present in Hinduism. Hindus can participate in Christ without acknowledging their participation in Christ. For instance, picture yourself as a poor Indian woman with your child on your breast. And you may not know where the next meal is coming from. It's not a very unlikely position if you're an Indian woman. and you are giving life from your breast to your child. This is a Christological image. To deny yourself, to transfer life from one to another. And this is just one image, but the Hindus conceive this kind of activity as participating in Christ. And they'll say, Jesus doesn't care if you acknowledge Jesus in this action. If you voluntarily give your life for someone else so they can have life, they don't care. They say, Jesus won't care, won't mind if you say this is Jesus or not. But you're participating in some resurrection activity when you do that. Christ, some Hindus say, is going to become more visible in Hinduism. For Christ has yet to be recognized. And when he does, Christ will be crucified in Hinduism as well, dying and rising as a resurrected Hindu. So there's going to be some Hindu, there is a Hindu view of Christ that uses the Hindu models, the Hindu methods, and they say there is an unknown Christ of Hinduism, even at work today. Now, this could be imperial. One way to criticize this is that it's a little bit imperialistic to say that, you know, that to that woman giving life to her child, you're actually Christian, not Hindu. But still, there's some value here in the unknown Christ of Hinduism. Moving on to China, Christ as the Tao. This is Tao, which means the way. You ever heard the way in Christianity? I am the way, John 14:6. This is the way. And I'm sure you've seen this image too. Timeline from point A to point B. There's not going to be a creation in year one and an eschaton, the last days with the fulfillment of history. There's not a progression. There is a cycle, and it continually meets itself. So it's going this way. And then there is, I think this is yang, and this is yin. Yang is the light. Yin is the dark. I mean, not necessarily a Greek or an Iranian dualism, but there are dual opposites. And they are not opposite from each other in opposition, but they are opposite in each other in pairs. And one, you cannot have one without the other. And look, and the neat thing about this to me as a Westerner is that you can never be wholly one, because you're all going to have some yin while you're yang, and yang while you're yin. And so, you know, to think Christologically about this, this could be representative of the humanity of Christ and the divinity of Christ. You've got it all together without separation, dually, not opposite, but dually joined. And the human side, if you want to say this, the human side has some divinity in it, and the divinity side has some humanity in it. It's a very creative way to think about Jesus. I mean, the image of Christ that we Westerners are dealing with is Chalcedonia. God is 100%, I mean, Jesus is 100% human and 100% God, joined together. This makes it a different statement here. So, the Taoist view of it emphasizes change, it emphasizes relativity, it emphasizes becoming over being. Being is a very Greek idea, very static. But this is an idea of becoming, emerging, changing. This links Christ with the Creator God. In this view, salvation is not a separate category from our creation. Sometimes we say that God created and then God saved. They'll say, in a Christological point of view, from their view, that salvation is also, that creation is also inclusive of salvation. Salvation is also inclusive of creation. You cannot say that God created in year X and then God saved in year Y. It's all one continuous process, intermixed, integrated, without discernible separations. To analyze this in Greek fashion, Western fashion, is to do violence by separating what should be unified. So, to continue speaking about Taoism, Christ can be seen as a center of our lives, but constantly changing. Christ is the perfect incarnation of the created world, perfect with full humanness, perfect with full divinity. He is both divine and human, as the yin and the yang relate. Neither can exist without the other. So this is another view. It's not that much developed right now because it is primarily a Chinese concept, and about 2% of all of Asia is Christian. You just don't have the numbers really right now to develop this. Where Christianity has taken off is in Korea. And the Christology that is in opposition to the Western missionary view will include some of the Taoist views, but it is the secular, suffering servant. Now, suffering servant, of course, is from Isaiah, and is one of the Jewish prescriptions for the Messiah. Secular would be a particularly Korean view, because in the Korean radical view of Christ, the religious Christ has done the most damage, because it's the colonial Christ that's come in and said you have to be this way, and it does violence to the culture by ignoring the culture. So this is a homegrown grassroots Christology from Korea. In Asia, where there's so much suffering, it is inevitable that Jesus Christ will be portrayed as a fellow sufferer. And because the mainline churches are not too fond of suffering, those interested in the suffering Jesus Christ will see Jesus as a secular suffering Christ. A Good Friday Christ, not an Easter Christ. Someone who's with them in the struggle, not up high on a hill, unapproachable.
Yeah, friend.
Friend, Jesus
yeah,
is friend.
Always friend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jesus has been seen as fellow proletariat, struggler, not for organized religion, but a struggler for God's reign, which will come whether there's organized churches or not. Jesus is therefore the man for others, as Bonhoeffer has said. His existence is for others. And a quote I have from one of the Asian theologians is, Jesus Christ today is living in the slums of modern Asian cities where the poor and the hungry are squirming. And Jesus says, these are my body. My blood is shed here. Whatever you do to the least of these people, you do to me. Very, that's from Matthew 25, a very low Christology in Western terms, but one that's with the people. And of course, the people are the most numerous. It's interesting to underscore that suffering and the secularity of Jesus are themes not connected to the church and organized religion. Jesus is a subject to follow, not an object to worship. And a very striking example of this is a play, and I'm not going to read all of it, of course, because it's a long play, but it's by a, a radical named Kim Chi-ha, or Chi-ha Kim in Western ways. And it's called the Gold-Crowned Jesus. And I really recommend it to you. It's by, and the title of the book is also the Gold-Crowned Jesus. And the family name is Kim. Kim Chi-ha, the Gold-Crowned Jesus. It takes place in a Korean city's ghettos. There are lepers, there are beggars, there are prostitutes. And they talk about their lives on a very cold night in that ghetto. And they talk about also the hypocrisy of some of the people who come visit them that night. A priest and a big corporation president. And all the while, all stage, if this could be a stage, there's this statue of Jesus that's lighted and has a gold crown. Very expensive, very ornate. Now, these, I just go ahead and read how these prostitutes and lepers are speaking about about the good Christians of the mainline churches, and then see how they integrate Jesus into their story, how they see Jesus. A leper talks, "I'm not saying that all Christians are good, but I like some kinds of Christians." And a beggar says, "You're out of your mind. Christians are all the same. They're all crooks. Can't you see that? I was raised in a Christian orphanage, and the Christians there were the biggest thieves of all. They worked your ass off and then only fed you thin corn soup because they had already robbed the funds. I've had my fill of Christians. I don't want to hear about them." The leper replies, I know what you mean. I was in a leper colony run by Christians, but now and then a decent one turns up." The beggar, "Damn it. Have you ever seen a virgin among the night soil flies? Crabs and crayfish all come from the same family. These Christians are all thieves." The leper says, "You don't understand it yet. There are some like that nun who just came by. She doesn't try to cheat people, and she doesn't try to smart talk her way into heaven. She really understands how things are, what it's like to be a have-not." And then a company president comes. "Give you money?" To the leper and the beggar. "Do you think I'm a fool? Since when do I know you well enough to give you my money? I had to make the great effort of putting my hand in my pocket as well as spoiling this unwrinkled, clean money for you, and I'd be taking the food out of my son's mouth. What a heartless and greedy bunch you are," crossing himself. "Amen. Isn't that true, Jesus?" And he looks up to Jesus. "Jesus, that gold crown on your head, it really suits you. It's perfect. You are truly the king of this world when you wear that crown. You are the king of kings. You are handsome. You're really handsome in that crown." "Dear Jesus, never forget that your gold crown was made from the cash contributed by yours truly last Christmas. Furthermore, Jesus, this year be sure that no one but me gets those contracts for all the missionary church construction, large or small." "Please, Jesus, help me make more money. And if you do that for me, Jesus, next Christmas I'll cast your whole body in gold. I'm not lying. Would it be right for one of your true believers to lie? No, I'm telling you the truth, Jesus. All you have to do is help me make a lot of money by constructing more churches. Amen." The leper is speaking now. And he's going into a soliloquy, and he's gradually speaking towards Jesus. "I have no village, no home, not even a temple to sleep in, nobody to welcome me. No man wants to call me his friend. Where shall I go? Jesus, Jesus, what could I possibly be to you? Why would you even bother with someone like me? Once I was a believer. But it's the clean, rich, educated people who believe in Jesus, those who pretend sympathy but run from me holding their noses, who give you a spoonful of scraps and rags and say they're generous, who say, 'You mustn't do this, you mustn't do that. And don't complain about being hungry, but suffer it. Jesus wants you to.' Even when they beat and abuse you, torment you, they say, 'This is necessary if you're to enter the kingdom of heaven.' And then they call it the will of God. When your house gets torn down, stay silent. Don't fight. Turn the cheek. Obey the masters, the gentlemen, the police, they tell you. Obey them, for these are the true believers.
This is what the people who wear luxurious clothes, eat rich food, and prove their high station by displaying their wealth like to say to us. They manipulate, sweet talk, deny us our souls, tame us into dumb, unquestioning dullheads, well-trained pups, while they enjoy their glory, their power. Ain't this true, Jesus? Tell me if I lie. Tell me if I say this because I'm stupid, because I know no better. Perhaps I don't know better. Can the ignorant ever know better? Can the abandoned beggar ever know better? And then he goes on, he gets into a paroxysm, if I say that word correctly, of pity and anger, and he's been drinking some rice wine, and he vomits on the statue of Jesus. And then the statue of Jesus starts crying. Am I drunk? Am I crazy? He is crying. These are his tears. Very strange, but can it be true? It doesn't make sense. This must be a very different kind of concrete. Ah, what is this? It's a crown of thorns made of gold. Can this be real gold? It is. It's really gold. I must look at this. And he removes the crown and looks at it. Wow, if I owned this, if it were really mine, I could use it and be cured of my disease. I could give money to the night soil flies to save their homes. I could buy food. I could have a wool jacket and wear insulated boots. Oh, how good my life could be if only I had this. It's very beautiful, a really nice crown. And then Jesus talks, why don't you take it with you? You may have it. And the leper says, did I just hear Jesus speak? Jesus says, there's nothing wrong with your hearing because you are an honest and poor man. And because of that, you have drawn me close to you. That is why you can now hear my words. Only the poor can hear. Jesus says, I have been closed up in this stone statue for a long, long time, entombed in this dark, lonely, suffocating prison. I have longed to talk with you, the kind and poor people like yourself. Share your sufferings. I can't begin to tell you how long I've waited for this day when you would liberate me from my prison, this day of liberation when I would live and burn again as a flame inside you, inside the very depths of your misery. But now you've finally come, and because you have come close to me, I can speak now. You are my rescuer. What can be done to rescue you, Jesus, to make you live again so that you can come to us? Asked the leper. Jesus replies, this is my last quote, my power alone is not enough. People like you must help to liberate me. Those who seek only the comforts, wealth, honor, and power of this world, who wish to enter the kingdom of heaven for themselves only and ignore the poor and less fortunate, cannot give me life again. Neither can these who have never suffered loneliness, who remain silent while injustice is done and so acquiesce to it, who are without courage. It is the same with those without courage who are unwilling to resist such evildoers as dictators and tyrants. Prayer alone is not enough. It is also necessary to act. Only those very poor and suffering like yourself, who are generous in spirit, can give me life again. You removed the gold crown from my head and so freed my lips to speak. Now remove this prison of cement. It is sufficient that I keep the crown of thorns. The crown of thorns is merely the insignia of those ignorant, greedy, and corrupt people who value only displays of external pomp and circumstance. Take it with you and share it with your friends. So Jesus doesn't need the gold in this situation. Any reactions to that play there? You've been a very quiet group.
This isn't so much a reaction to the play, but I'm a little bit confused about before you went into the three different Christologies,
yeah.
You spoke a little bit about liberation theology and your concerns and reservations about that.
Yeah.
And yet we've kind of come back to only the poor can hear Jesus. So I'm struggling with the two different messages of that and how that kind of then fits together. Do they just...
The message that only the poor can hear Jesus and then the three Christologies I presented?
Well, you voiced some concerns about liberation theology, which I also have the same kind of questions. But then the models that, or the particularly this last one, that you've come back into, and the play has also held up that only the poor can hear Jesus. And while a part of me really can understand and see that, and see that biblically in Jesus and Matthew and whatever, a part of me and my experience also feels excluded from that as well.
I know.
Like you were sharing.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily say only the poor can hear Jesus. It says, the message is that you have to be in a and for community, in order to hear Jesus to a message,
right.
Doesn't exclude us completely in that sense, because it gives us some space that we can share our suffering.
Can you speak louder? Because there's outside noise.
We can hear. I mean, we can hear Jesus by putting ourselves in their situation. I think that's what missionaries do too.
You know, we've talked kind of round and round this issue all week long with going to the different sessions. And, you know, I think probably when you were saying the unknown Christ of Hinduism, I would say what we need to discover in our country maybe is the unknown Christ of capitalism. I don't think it's impossible for capitalist people to know Christ. I think probably a better way to phrase it is that the poor are greatly in touch with their need, and they need God. I think we, with our apathy, have a harder time needing God. It's not impossible to meet God, but I think we need to discover it's essential. I think that we come to grips with our needs, and poverty is not one of them. And so we need to give witness back, you know, to those who we are in touch with in this culture, to find a way to communicate how we need God. And I think we're not doing a good job of that because we are affluent. And some people are saying you need to be impoverished to discover God. And I think because it's easy to see how dependent impoverished people are on God, and we're so independent, we need to seek to discover ways we can become dependent and communicate that to affluent people.
I think also that we're in denial of the kinds of suffering that we experience. I mean, I think
yes, because if we're independent, then we can't be needy.
We're some sense, insulated from our suffering. And I think of the rich man and his superficial perspective. And I can't help but believe that underneath that is a great deal of suffering.
Ed Schrader, in his Bible studies, was giving the model of, you know, kind of, that there are three parts of the person, the internal, the external, and the eternal. And I guess I would also argue that if you are impoverished, perhaps your relationship with God is very dependent. However, I think it's difficult to be altruistic if you're impoverished, because your own needs are so great. How can I help my neighbor? I'm so busy, you know, with my own life.
No, that's not true. If you are impoverished in real life, you tend to share more. I've never seen such just ownership, greed, like in the United States. I watch children, and I have 5-year-old daughter who was born here and raised here and goes to school, very nice private school, and so she made mine, so to speak. And I live in international house where we have a lot of international students, graduate students. For a short time, they stay in New York City and getting special training or just do something, or medical doctors or whoever. And I compare these children. These children don't have any ownership, greed. If they bring their toys, it's for everybody. While my child and I see American kids, and it's obvious, it's so distinctive that this is mine. You can use it, but it has to come back to me, and it's very clear. This is mine, and this is yours, and this is mine. It's very clear.
Because we teach that. We teach that to our children. Right. But I do think,
but if you're very poor, the line, you know, it's, you share.
Well, I think if you're very, very poor, there are many people who are willing to share with what little they have.
Right.
However, I think the more extreme your poverty is, you have to spend a great deal of your time just sustaining yourself. No, and I think that that's true. The less you have, the easier it is to give. But I think what we need to do is seek in our culture to find opportunity. That we need to, take those lessons from other cultures and turn outward and absorb some of those lessons. But I do feel disheartened when I feel like there cannot be such a thing as a Western Christian anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think and I think we need to struggle at how then do we become.
Would you suggest, Mark, if our missionary efforts have imported our Western Christology, which wasn't relevant to Asian culture and to their needs, it seems now what we are wanting to do, some of us are wanting to import second, third world theologies into Western society as better or ought to be relevant to us.
Yeah.
And are they? Is there something per se wrong with theology of glory, with our
if it's
triumphalism?
If it's the only vision of Christ, I say it's heretical. Because it denies the cross. And the cross is on Friday. And you got to have the palace there. And so.
And is there some validity to our theology of glory for Asian culture? Or should we?
I don't know. I would want them to say that.
Did they get it right because of their.
Yeah.
And did we get it wrong because we've become too, is money the root of all evil? I mean, what's...
You're asking me?
I'm a leader. I'm thinking of my affluent congregation.
Not yours.
Yeah.
What's the message to give to my affluent congregation? Who desperately want to be good Christians.
My view is... That to get their bodies into a situation where they don't have, where they cannot rely on their money to get them out, and that would be somehow to live in a different way for a time and understand existentially, incarnationally, what it's like for different Christians, even in your neighborhood, to be a Christian. How they define it. What does Christianity smell like? What does it hear? What do you? How does it come in through your senses? Christianity is a sensual religion. It can be. How do other people articulate it? And how do they say, how do they define it for themselves? Then come back to your congregation. Come back. Talk about how you felt. Then see how this is relevant anymore. And how much of it you'd like to keep for yourself, how much you think should go somewhere else. What kind of priorities are being reoriented? So, I think that until our bodies know something, we don't know nothing, to use another negative. So until our bodies are learning different things, and our adrenaline is flowing in different ways, we're not going to learn what it's like to be poor, person of color,
people in the world live. We don't live like most people in the world live. Until we understand existentially, excuse me for preaching, but until we understand existentially what it's like for people of color and women of color to live like they have to, we ain't going to get it. We're not going to change one iota, maybe 1 or 2%. But we're not talking about 1 or 2. It's not a 1 or 2% solution. Am I coming across?
I think the biggest obstacle that I think in American Christianity is apathy.
Which is a kind of suffering.
Yeah, but until people realize it is, I think that's it. I think we want to...
Right, I think that...
But it's an electable suffering. I'm saying that most of the people have no choice in their suffering. Get to a place where you have no choice about your suffering. Apathy we can work on. It's electable. It's an option. Get to a place where you have no options. Then start talking about Jesus with other people who have no options too. Then see what kind of Christology emerges. I've been ignoring that.
The only thing that I struggle with, I mean, I affirm so much of what you're saying, but a couple images emerge for me that trouble me. One is that I am trouble-free in my life.
Yeah.
No, you're not. Care. No, but I say, but and suffering.
I overstate things on purpose in order
to... No, I understand it, but I mean, that's the danger in the conversation, it seems to me. Yeah. I find my options really narrowed at my stage of life.
Well, don't you think that in the older generation, they had it much harder than we, I mean, or than our children. And that's why, of course, everything was centered around the churches, and they went to church, and they had a much harder life. And so they were believers, our grandparents, say, our parents, grandparents. But now our younger generation, we don't need it, they say. And so they're self-sufficient in themselves.
Right.
They don't need church, they don't need God. And so we're getting more and more away from it. And atheism.
One good option for your church is there a Habitat for Humanity nearby?
Yeah.
That's one way of getting people to get their bodies out of their usual routines and sweat and work and listen and smell and hear other Christians and how they live. That's one way, one introduction.
Immersion projects are
immersion projects.
And I think that those are being revitalized today. There's some
right,
I assume
yeah.
around here. Today.
Right.
Okay. But another thing I was going to say is the other danger I think is kind of making a virtue of poverty. The glorification of poverty. And there's a, because we create a new elitism, which is over against the gospel.
But yeah, all I'm saying is that the poor are always going to be there. The poor are always going to have these needs, and our time is up. and so if they're going to always be there, and if they're understanding Christianity differently, that means they're in the majority in our world, and we're in a minority. And it might behoove us to get to live through some of this thing. And to get all five senses involved. So, I'll be glad to stick around, but we're setting in 5 minutes.
I like what you said. I,